talking about our brothers that we have seen, some lessons from some ruins, some Mayan ruins that we visited, and then Abraham jumping off of a cliff. So you'll get to wait until the end of the sermon to see what that's talking about. So first of all, mindset. What do you notice about this picture? Just anything. Think of it as a trick question or not a trick question. Just what do you notice? So whatever that is, how does that make you feel? Does it have any effect on you? Emotionally, intellectually? Does it make you, does that feeling then make you want to do something? Does it make you want to change something? Something about this picture, does it make you wish that something was different? So here's what I notice. I notice a 20-year-old young man named Yosmar translating the same sermon for Adam for the third time because it's a good sermon, but we're traveling to different places, so different brethren are getting to hear the sermon, but Yosmar is practicing to be able to help. When English-speaking brethren visit this area to encourage people, he wants to be a part of that in the role of a translator. And so he's practicing and learning that capability that that older men with more experience and experience with the English language over, that he does that. Yosmar wants to be able to work in that way, to serve in that way. I notice who is under the tarp and who is not. And you wouldn't be able to pick this up from just looking at the picture too much, but the visitors to this congregation, to their place of meeting, are under the tarp. I suppose that, we're well shaded. Those who are off to the side next to the wall of the kitchen of this family's homestead, those are the locals. And the sun is starting to creep in on them. They're less shaded. So here, they're showing honor, they're showing hospitality to those in what they have that they can provide for us. And there are other men who are standing back behind the picture here, not taking preferred seating, if you will. I notice new friends, you can barely see them, but Mexican and American friends who have become good friends. I notice there are brethren from at least four different churches in Mexico and two different churches in the U.S. Adam probably notices that the tarp is not right above his head just roasting him. It's raised up. It's a more comfortable height for a tall guy like him. But can we talk about something that's pretty obvious that probably is the first thing we all notice? I'm giving you permission to notice it. The standard of accommodations, of living, it's hard to understand how different it is. And it's okay to notice that. That was certainly something that stood out to me wherever we were, in the city, out in the countryside, that was very different, a great disparity in the standard of living, the accommodations for worship. The things that we thank God for that provide us a place that's free from distraction. And there were dogs and chickens around here and parakeets in a cage right back here. You could say there are a lot of distractions, but we could listen to the word still. But there's this great disparity in that standard of living. And all of this affected me profoundly, but not in the way I expected. And maybe not in the way that you would expect. Because it wasn't the difference in the standard of living that affected me. I've been friends with Tondurai in Zimbabwe and see pictures and hear reports from him for too long. And I see pictures and hear reports from people who've gone on this trip or to other places like it too much that any of this was a surprise to me. I've seen all of this before, albeit just in pictures. So that didn't shock me. There wasn't anything new in that way. And I'm going to try to communicate how it affected me, and I'm going to fail, but I'm going to do my best. Because it's not what you see in the picture, it's what you can't see. We might look at these folks and say, these are poor saved people. Or if we're more careful, we might put the saved part first. We're like, these are Christians who are poor. If we're really on it, we would say, well, these are Christians who are wealthy in the spiritual sense. And I believe that to be true. I don't know them that well, but I believe that to be true. But they're still poor. They're mainly, like, that's the thing that we think of. They are Christians, but mostly they're poor Christians. But when I asked myself the question, how does that make me feel, this is what rocked me. I was shocked by how little my emotions responded as pity. You look at this and you're like, oh, they look at that situation. I pity them a lot. And that didn't happen to me, hardly at all. Because when I asked that first question, what do you notice? What I noticed when I met these people was a great impression of wealth, of richness. I met a person, and everything within me said, this is a rich person. And it wasn't an abstract sense, like the Bible says they're rich, so I guess I should say they're rich. That was how it affected me as people. They weren't soldiering along with eyes downcast, just, you know, going to be strong in the faith in spite of my circumstances, but really focused on those hard circumstances. They were joyful people, loving people, with bright eyes, not downcast. And so I met the people, and then you go to their homes and realize this home is a shelter. It provides for the needs of life. And my opinion of those people didn't change when I saw their house or when I saw their place of worship. Those people are still rich. And so what happened was this strange disconnect to my American mind, and I had to recalibrate. So once I saw their homes and I saw their places of worship, I said, this is what a rich person's home looks like. This is what a rich congregation's place of meeting looks like. It's not a paradox, it's harmony. This is the truth. So who am I to say that they need more of something in their life when they are joyful in their situation? Who am I to say that their standard of living should be more like our society, where we have miserable people in wonderful accommodations? Now, I'm specifically speaking of the brethren here. I don't know that those who are outside of Christ living in these same circumstances are any more joyful than people here in different circumstances, but specifically of the brethren there. And rather than causing me to pity our Mexican brethren, it caused me to pity the Americans. Us, and the people around us especially, who don't have Christ. Instead of pity, I felt a little bit of jealousy. Hopefully not to a sinful degree, but there's something there that is good and desirable. The simplicity of a life where you only have things, the only things you have are related to what is most important. The things for this life, the essentials of this life. And then everything else is for a life that's much better than this life could ever be in America or anywhere else. I'm not advocating that we make ourselves poor or needy. You know what Jesus called all the stuff we have? He called it thorns. Matthew 13, verse 22 said, and the one on whom seed was sown among the thorns, this is the man who hears the word, like all of us, and the worry of the world and the deceitfulness of wealth choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful. Is that entirely possible to happen to us? The deceitfulness of wealth, and make no mistake, we are all wealthy in the way he's talking about here. That deceitfulness that I think I've got the stuff I need, and it's way more than I need, that can choke the word. So I come to you with a plea, not for mercy for these people in this situation, but for yourself, for your family, that we could uproot the weeds from our lives, the worries and cares of wealth, so we can focus on only the most important things. In Proverbs chapter 30 and verse 7, he says, two things I ask of you, do not refuse me before I die. Keep deception and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is my portion. that I will not be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? Or that I not be in want and steal and profane the name of my God. Do you ever pray this? I hear it in prayer sometimes or sentiments expressed. What do we mean when we say that? Do we mean, let me keep my standard of living except for the hardships? I don't want a lot more. But I definitely don't want less. It'd be nice to not have the hardships, just have everything nice, kind of where it is, with maybe a car that's a bit newer so it doesn't break down as much. Is that what we mean? What if the best thing for us is to hit what we think of as hard times? Are we courageous enough to pray that prayer and mean that when we say those words? We'll pause for just a second and reflect on our blessings and our giving.
Go out in prayer and reflect. Dear Lord in heaven, as we come to you this morning, I think it's really good that we got that perspective, Lord, of how blessed we truly are and how being spiritually rich and physically rich just means different things, Lord. And help us to take those things and take the lessons that we're learning this morning and give back with an open heart, Lord, and to take that perspective and let it have an impact on us, Lord, and to give back to you, because nothing that we have really is ours, Lord. It's what you've given us, and we pray this in your name. Amen.
I do feel like I should have a disclaimer here. These folks at this time, when we were visiting, weren't in great need. If water was running through there, or it was the middle of winter, like there are other circumstances that we could have encountered. Could have been a hardship and, you know, they didn't have enough food or something like that. Those things happen. I'm not saying we should ignore that and just say, well, they're happy, so let's not be helpful in times of need. I'm not saying that at all. It's just that our expectation of what need is, maybe we have too much and we need less. So saying all of that, I feel like this is a good perspective for us to get to. But all of that being said, I'm really annoyed with myself that it caught my attention at all, because it really caught my attention. 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 16, he says, therefore, from now on we recognize no one according to the flesh, even though we have known Christ according to the flesh, yet now we know him in this way no longer. In chapter 10 and verse 3, he says, for though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. In Galatians chapter 5 and verse 16, he says, but I say, walk by the Spirit, and you will not carry out the desire of the flesh. For the flesh sets its desire against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. In chapter 6 and verse 8, for the one who sows to his own flesh will from the flesh reap corruption, but the one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap eternal life. Now, a lot of times, most of the time in the New Testament, when he talks about the flesh and the Spirit, the flesh is sinful. It's not just physical, it is sinful, and the Spirit is life. But those are the two things that he contrasts. He doesn't allow for a third, where we can be physically minded, but not sinful. We can be physically minded and yet have not be spiritual. There's not a place in the middle. So we should just be careful. Even if we have the proper attitude towards the flesh, if we become fixated on it and we don't think about the Spirit, that's what annoyed me in myself, was how much I noticed the physical things. Now, I give myself a little bit of a pass because I couldn't even talk to most of the brethren to any extent, so it's not as though I could dig into some spiritual topics with them and get to know what are their needs in the kingdom. All you can do is observe, and you see physical things. So that's the same with pictures. That's the same with being there when you can't talk a lot with people, but still, it bothered me. You think about, we talk about marriage. If all we do is focus on divorce, and what's wrong about divorce and when is it allowed, like, that doesn't make for good marriages. And that's kind of the point here. It's all, we can have the right attitude towards physical things, but if we fixate on that and we neglect the spiritual things, it's not good for us. Jesus told the rich young ruler to go and sell all he had and give to the poor. And come and follow me. We can't forget about the spiritual side of things, even when we're working really hard to have a good attitude towards physical things. Second observation. My brother whom I have seen. Brethren, love brethren. In 1 John chapter 4 and verse 20, John says, if someone says, I love God and hates his brother, he is a liar. For the one who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. I never realized that there was a gulf, basically an impassable gulf between how someone who met these people, who took those pictures, feels about the people in the picture versus what they can communicate to anyone else looking at the picture. I saw these same people a year ago, and I thought, that's nice. I'm glad we have brethren in Mexico. I'm glad some folks went and got to meet them. It did not prepare me for how I feel about those same people now that I've actually seen them. I've actually been with them, broken bread with them. So seeing your brother means more than just a visual observation. You can all see these people. And Lindsay could tell last week I was struggling to communicate the impact that meeting these brethren had on me. And I won't be able to do it. To know your brethren, to see them truly, and not just recognize a face, it's important. And this passage, 1 John chapter 4, implies something, that when we see our brother, it should just naturally flow that we love him. And that's what happened to me. I love these people. And it didn't take long. When you see them, when you know them, to love them. They're very lovable people. As brethren ought to be. So when you see people in this auditorium and you know their face, it's not the same as knowing them. So take time to get to know each other. What does it mean to love your brother? First of all, there's a desire. When you love someone, you want to be with them. And 1 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 6, Paul talks about the Thessalonians in this way. Now that Timothy has come to us from you and has brought us good news of your faith and love, and that you always think kindly of us, longing to see us, just as we also long to see you. For this reason, brethren, in all our distress and affliction, we were comforted about you through your faith. For now we really live if you stand firm in the Lord. For what thanks can we render to God for you in return for all the joy with which we rejoice before our God on your account, as we night and day keep praying most earnestly that we may see your face and we may complete what is lacking in your faith. You know how long Paul was with the Thessalonians? If I remember right, it's about 2 weeks. I meant to check that. He was not with them long, but he longed for them after getting to know them, after seeing their obedience to Christ and the effect that Christ had in their lives. So that's what we ought to do. For anyone, I love my brother, but I don't want to be near him. That's not loving your brother. You long to be with them. Secondly is joy. There was so much laughter. And I'd heard about this being the case with folks who visited Mexico, visited Nicaragua. You look at the circumstances, and then it's just completely opposite of what we'd expect. So much laughter. But it wasn't, and that kind of, my family, when it's just us, we have plenty of fun, silliness and whatnot in our house. But in other ways, I'm a pretty serious-minded person, and it's like, I don't know if I can handle that. Just, you know, a lot of joking around and all that. And if it was just silliness, just flippancy, people who didn't care and so they just had a good time because it was just fun, I think that would have worn on me. But what I saw instead was so much joy, and that was the foundation of love and joy, that it just overflowed. And so there was a lot of laughter, a lot of smiles. As in Colossians 3, verse 16, talks about being filled with the Spirit. And what happens? You overflow with songs. And when you're overfilled with joy in each other's presence, there's a lot of laughter happening. It's just it's abundant. But loving our brethren also means loving those who are difficult to love. These folks were easy to love. I couldn't talk with them a whole lot, so we couldn't get into stuff that might be hard to talk about. It's easy to be unified when you don't really know anything about each other. Hopefully that would still hold true if we got to know each other, you know, to the nth degree. But it was easy in that situation with hospitality and joy to just love people. But sometimes it's not easy. Sometimes the brother that we see is giving us heartache, heartburn. In Luke chapter 13, verse 34, Jesus shows his love for those who were really hard to love. For centuries, they were hard to love. He said, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together just as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not have it." He loved them like a mother, like a father, like children he loved them. And they stoned those that were sent to them. He loved them anyway. And of course, on the cross, he said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." So we need to love those when it's hard to love them too. Love must be sincere, more than lip service. In 1 John chapter 3, verse 18, you might turn to 1 John 3. We'll be there for a few verses. He says, "Little children, let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth." Not just with words that, oh, eventually it's warm, we're welcoming, we greet each other, and we smile, but indeed and in truth, when it's hard and when it takes sacrifice. Which brings us to our next point, being willing to lay down our lives, to live our lives, laying them down. In verse 16 of 1 John chapter 3, "We know love by this, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren." It may mean helping with earthly or physical needs. Verse 17, "Whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him?" What if we don't have a lot of world's goods? I still saw love in this place. Literally, water and a towel. Jesus in John chapter 13, verse 14 said, "If I then, the Lord and the teacher, washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you also should do as I did to you." When we were in Oaxaca, we were away from our home base back in San Cristobal, where we all had showers, hot water. They had a cold water shower, but they had it available for us, and they were making sure to get towels so that we could get cleaned up and rest well and enjoy being around each other. But Sister Fermi, she was getting towels, and then when somebody's clothes who had gotten real wet from walking through the dewy grass and the high humidity and everything, she went and washed them by hand and hung them up to dry. That was service like Jesus is talking about. "To love my brother, I must practice righteousness myself." Back to 1 John chapter 3 and verse 10. "By this, the children of God and the children of the devil are obvious. Anyone who does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor the one who does not love his brother." And this is especially true because I must be ready and able to help my brother with his most important needs. In chapter 5 and verse 16, "If anyone sees his brother committing a sin not leading to death, he shall ask, and God will for him give life to those who commit sin not leading to death." We need to be discipline ourselves in our own lives so that we can be ready and able to help those who are in need spiritually. Lessons from Tonina. These are Mayan ruins. Pretty interesting to dig into the background on this. But I'll have to breeze through this and note a few lessons that just kind of were running through my mind as we visited these ruins. This is it's difficult to get the sense of scale. You can see people there, and this is a very high, you could call it a pyramid. It's kind of built on the side of a mountain, but it's basically a tall, one-sided pyramid, if you will. Made me, like, just think about Genesis chapter 11, where the people in Babel were building a tower. It's about that time, not long after the Tower of Babel, when they first start seeing development in Central America, in this region. And you see pyramids there, you see pyramids, like, I think there's a connection. The people were dispersed, and then they started kind of doing the same thing they were doing, but they couldn't do it all together. Anyway, this is very old. And generally speaking, you've got Chichen Itza and multiple other sites throughout this Mesoamerican area where the Mayans were building these kinds of structures, and they had a very developed society in terms of advancements and civilization as we think of it. They did all that. And it lasted for hundreds of years, but about 900 AD, their cities, the people didn't disappear. The Mayans are still there. They're like pure blood Mayans, if you will, and then intermingled with the rest of the population. But the people live on, but this civilization doesn't as such. In about 900, it started falling off, and there are different theories as to why it was war or famine or drought or all different things or a combination of factors. It got too big, the cities were decimating their resources and so forth. The jungle consumed these places. This was a fairly recent find in terms of 2-3 decades ago. They started clearing this out, and so this is very recent. They're still finding things that are buried deeper than the jungle with flying over with LIDAR and seeing structures that they can't see because the jungle covers it. It's incredible what is the evidence of what once was there. Cities, not villages, not rural. It was a great civilization, and it's gone. Consumed by the creation of God. This is something like a soccer pitch. I don't know. This is about the size of a basketball court. But they play this game where they bounce a ball back and forth and bump it with their knees and hips and whatnot. We don't know a lot about how it was played, but they would use a latex ball from the latex in the trees, rubber ball, and they'd bounce it around, and then they would sacrifice people at the end of it. And they would do bloodletting. And it seems to be, from my research, a few hours of research, there's a combination of, it could be your enemies that you have captured, and so you put them out there and they play, and then you sacrifice whoever, leverages the most power for you. Typically beheading. And it's all of this stuff going on, so it's partly political, it's partly a power play, but it's also tied into their religion. And they have stories about these two brothers who were playing this game, and then the gods in the underworld were annoyed by all the ruckus from their playing the game, and they brought them down, and they killed them, and then there were twin sons that came down, and those twins tricked the gods, and like it's this whole thing, and one of them gets beheaded, the head is put on a tree as a trophy by the gods, and then that tree turns into, like, makes more people, like it's a whole thing woven into their religion. And sacrifices and so forth. We might want to go to the Holy Land to see where Jesus walked, but it's insightful to go to places like this and understand this is really where. This is like Egypt. It's very much like Egypt. There in their religion, the rulers were gods. The kings of these city-states were gods. That's this is his name. And this first one is kind of a title, Sun-Faced Radiant, their sun god, who then becomes a jaguar at night and travels through the underworld to defeat the darkness. So his name, his title, is that of a god, much like the pharaohs. But then they have elements that sound a lot like the Canaanites with the bloodletting. So this is their religion. And but then we see what happened to them. This kind of sums it up. All flesh is as grass, and all its loveliness is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades, when the breath of the Lord blows upon it, surely the people are grass. These people, as great as they were in their time, are gone. There's nobody in this tomb. Not even there. They're gone. The grass withers, the flower fades. When the breath of the Lord blows upon it, surely the people are grass. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God endures forever. And that is what we need to learn from that. There's kind of a common theme here. The physical things of this life should not be a determining factor in our perspective at all. Because as great a civilization as the Mayans had, it's gone. As great a civilization as we might think we live in, it will be gone someday. It will change. We will be gone for sure. And so we need to try to look beyond the wealth or the poverty. In James chapter 1, verse 9, he says, "But the brother of humble circumstances is to glory in his high position, and the rich man is to glory in his humiliation." I've talked a lot about the brethren in Mexico, and I wanted to be sure and include a picture of you all. This is what I could find on my phone, because I rejoice to be with all of you. And if I was away from you a long time, I would long for you as well. But it's good to be with you, and it's good to be back home. So I don't want it to sound like, well, it's all perfect down there and I have to be back here. That's not it. I do miss them terribly, but I'm also glad to be home. But in whatever circumstances we find ourselves, whether it's in Mexico or Central Texas or somewhere in the middle, we should glory in God. How can we do that? You look to Abraham's example. There were a combination of things that just led to this observation, and then we'll be done. Just before we left, Annie and I and another student were taking karate tests, and we had to break bricks. And you're standing there in front of the bricks, and some of the students, you go through the motions to prep. And then when it comes time to try to break them, if your mind has not already broken the bricks, it won't happen. If you think, I'm going to move my arm and see what happens, you won't break the bricks. You'll pull up, you'll stop short, and you'll hurt your hand. And you've seen this. This is at the cenote that we visited, where our folks were jumping off the cliff. Some folks would get up, they'd go right off. But if there's any hesitation, you've seen it out here at the lake. It doesn't matter what your body tries, what you try to do with your body. You can kind of rock back and forth like you're about to jump. You can get your arms swinging. You can have a countdown. It doesn't matter. You will not go off until you have already jumped in your mind. Once you do that, once you have already committed, once you have decided, I am going off right now, you will not stop. You are going off. And it's the same with the bricks. I've already broken the bricks. Now my body is following suit. I'm jumping off the cliff. This is how God described what happened with Abraham. In Genesis chapter 22, Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven, "For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." He said, "You have done this thing." Abraham did not kill Isaac, but he had already killed him. I don't know when he killed him. If it was the morning before, the night before when God said, "Do it," and he's dead. Or if it was on the way. As long as there was a chance for him to stop, he could have stopped. But at some point, God saw that Abraham had killed his son. Physically, his body had not caught up yet But Abraham had killed his son. And God said, you did it. You've already jumped off the cliff. You've already broken the bricks. You have killed your son. How did he do that, though? Yes, he was physically stopped. God interrupted the process and kept it from happening, but he had done it. How? By faith. Abraham trusted that God could raise up his son. And this is a great point that this is Adam's last sermon was on Abraham, and so all these things came together. That somehow he knew that God could raise up his son. He just trusted. And because of that, he was able to do what he needed to do. So we can trust God. We can turn loose of our physical ties. We can have the right perspective on him. We can focus on the things that we need to focus on. We can love brethren who are very different from us. We can love brethren that it's hard to love if we have faith like Abraham. If we can do anything to help you come to God, please come as we stand and as we sing.